because of where this, their schools are. Recently, I've been reading about something called redlining, and it talks about how, you know, residences of, you know, black and brown communities, they were marked red because they were, this is historically, because they were a high risk for mortgages. So meaning that communities of black and brown people, they weren't able historically, you know, to, they weren't able to get housing that is safe for them, or housing in safe spaces, in healthy, you know, spaces, spaces that we could see having more, you know, more parks or,
Vanessa,
you know, more.
The show is ending. I want to thank you so much for being with us again. Vanessa Nakate has just written a new book. It is called A Bigger Picture.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Fred Meyer and QFC union workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington vote to authorize a strike. State lawmakers meet for a special session to address rental assistance and eviction protections. And the U.S. sets a somber record as the number of COVID-19 deaths in the country surpasses 800,000. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 13th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Fred Meyer and QFC union workers voted Saturday to authorize a strike on the grounds of unfair labor practices. United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555, which represents 29,000 workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington, said the vote happened because the companies have a disregard for federal labor laws that, quote, has spilled over into negotiations. According to a union press release, members voted overwhelmingly to call for a strike. Union President Dan Clay said, quote, Fred Meyer and QFC have repeatedly violated their legal duties to negotiate in good faith with Local 555, with the most blatant example being Fred Meyer's refusal to provide information necessary for the union to negotiate a new agreement and to process grievances. The way these employers have violated the National Labor Relations Act has left grocery workers no choice but to take action, end quote. The union accused the stores, which are both subsidiaries of Kroger, of not paying their employees enough to keep up with the cost of living. The union said it's been in negotiations for a new contract for the workers since July of 2021. The companies and the union will continue to bargain through this week. Workers plan to go on strike beginning Friday morning if union leadership and management cannot reach an agreement by then on key bargaining issues. The Oregon legislature held a special session Monday to deal with rental assistance, eviction protections, and other pressing issues. Lawmakers will address eviction protections for renters as more than 8,000 households are at risk of eviction. Protections keeping them housed have expired as more than 22,000 households are still waiting to be reviewed for state aid. Lawmakers are considering a two-bill package and weighing putting $215 million toward eviction protection and rental assistance. The two bills are Senate Bill 891 and Senate Bill 5561. Under SB 891, renters who have not paid rent but had applied for emergency rent relief on or before June 30th of next year and showed their landlords that they applied would be safe from eviction for non-payment of rent until the fall of 2022. Under SB 5561, lawmakers would put funding towards the Oregon Emergency Rental Assistance Program, local emergency rental assistance programs, and Home Forward, Portland's housing authority that compensates landlords. As of Monday afternoon, the Joint Committee on the second special session, a bicameral committee, has passed both bills to a floor vote. Governor Kate Brown is planning to propose $100 million in relief funds to help those impacted by 2021 summer drought, $25 million to address what she calls the proliferation of illegal cannabis, and $18 million to support the resettlement of Afghan refugees in Oregon. Legislators also plan to discuss other priority issues, such as the Oregon Health Plan's dental plan, as well as the East Metro Prevention and Intervention Program. The U.S. passed another grim COVID-19 milestone on Monday, as the country's death toll surpassed 800,000 people. That's more than any other nation, and more than the population of Washington, D.C. or Seattle. The number is expected to increase Monday as more state and local health departments update their data. 75% of people who have died of the virus in the U.S. have been aged 65 or older. That means 1 in 100 older Americans have died from the virus. For people younger than 65, that ratio is closer to 1 in 1,400. According to the most recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the 7-day death average in the U.S. was up 27.8% from the week before. In total, the country has recorded nearly 50 million cases since the pandemic began. About 64% of people aged 5 and older in the U.S. have completed their vaccine series. Last month, the CDC strengthened its recommendations about booster shots, advising everyone over the age of 18 to get a booster 6 months after their second Pfizer or Moderna shot, or 2 months after their Johnson & Johnson vaccine. A man from Texas was sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison on Monday after assaulting a deputy U.S. Marshal with a hammer during a July 2020 protest in Portland. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Oregon identified the man as 24-year-old Jacob Michael Gaines. U.S. District Judge Karen Immergut chose a sentence that exceeded the recommended 3 years and 1 month sentence that federal prosecutors had requested in a negotiated plea deal. Calling a 3-year sentence insufficient, Gaines was sentenced to 46 months in prison, followed by 3 years of post-prison supervised release. Officials say Gaines was seen on July 11, 2020, using a hammer to break through a barricaded entrance to the Hatfield Federal Courthouse in downtown Portland. Law enforcement on the other side of the door exited to stop Gaines from entering. As they did so, Gaines hit a deputy U.S. Marshal 3 times with a hammer. Officials say the deputy deflected the blows but was hit in the left shoulder, lower neck, and upper back. Gaines was charged with assaulting a federal officer with a deadly weapon. He was then indicted by a federal jury in Portland on the same charge. Gaines is among a handful of defendants who have pled guilty to federal charges stemming from arrests related to the nightly protests in downtown Portland last year. Of 96 federal protest-related prosecutions from last year, 70 have been dismissed. About 20 cases are pending with trial dates scheduled, and 6 people have been sentenced. The pending prosecutions include defendants charged with civil disorder, destruction of government property, and arson. Researchers have found that Oregon State Police troopers disproportionately give out tickets to motorists of color compared with white drivers. According to an Oregon Criminal Justice Commission analysis, state troopers disproportionately stop drivers of Asian, Pacific Islander, Black, Latino, Middle Eastern, and Native American descent, creating a statistically significant racial disparity. Additionally, Native drivers were more likely than whites to be arrested when troopers stopped them, and drivers of Middle Eastern heritage were more likely than whites to be subject to searches that turned up empty. There were 143 law enforcement agencies included in the study, but state police were the only ones whose data registered disproportionate traffic stops on two of the three statistical models that the commission analyzed. The report used data from almost 500,000 traffic stops initiated by law enforcement officers between July 1st of 2020 and June 30th of 2021. State troopers pulled over the largest share of drivers and about 130,000 motorists. Researchers recommended further data analysis and that state troopers seek training from the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The trial of former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter, who shot and killed Dante Wright during a traffic stop in April, continues this week. One racial justice scholar says the trial underscores the need for broader conversations that address police brutality and reimagine public safety. With more on the story, it's Safiya Muhammad with the Racial Reckoning Project.
The trial of former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter for the killing of Dante Wright continues this week. Dr. Yehuru Williams is a professor of history at the University of St. Thomas and the founding director of the school's Racial Justice Initiative.
The efficiency with which the trial is being run up until this point, I've been very impressed with the pacing. Seems like the judge has a great command of the courtroom and wants to make sure that this is going to proceed without any hitches.
Williams says this trial is particularly challenging because one can argue that Potter just made a mistake in drawing her service pistol instead of her taser. However, he stresses the importance of accountability.
The larger conversation we need to have is around policies, practices, and procedures that facilitated what happened in that afternoon. The fact that that stop, to begin with, was unnecessary is one of those conversations we need to be having. How do we change the law to minimize these types of encounters to begin with?
Williams says there is much work that needs to be done outside of the trial in order to address police brutality. He suggests a holistic approach to reimagining public safety.
It's not just body cams and technology. It's kind of reimagining criminal justice in a way that says, what's our end goal here? Is it to make everyone safer, including officers, in the performance of their duty? Or is it simply to empower police to reign over, to be able to occupy communities?
Williams believes that through restorative practices, society can collectively work to tackle police brutality and reduce cases like this from happening in the first place. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Safiya Muhammad.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center, online at racialreckoningmn.org.
One of the Louisville detectives who fatally shot Breonna Taylor during a botched raid in Kentucky is appealing his termination from the police department. The Louisville Metro Police Department terminated Miles Cosgrove in January for use of deadly force for firing 16 rounds into Taylor's home and failing to activate his body camera. Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron says Cosgrove fired the shot that killed Taylor. Cameron said this was justified because Taylor's boyfriend fired at officers first. Kenneth Walker II, who was Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, said he thought the officers were intruders and fired one shot when they broke down the door, prompting officers to return fire, riddling the apartment with bullets. Part of Cosgrove's hearings took place in November. The second half of his hearing is set to begin Monday and end Wednesday. Taylor's death, along with that of other Black people at the hands of law enforcement, sparked a summer of protests calling for police reform. No officer who took part in the botched raid was charged for Taylor's killing. Only one of the three officers, Brett Hankison, was charged in connection for the shooting. The department fired Hankison in June of 2020, and in September of that year, a grand jury charged him with three counts of felony wanton endangerment for blindly firing 10 shots into Taylor's home, to which he pled not guilty. Hankison is expected to stand trial in 2022. Wanton endangerment is a Class D felony, Kentucky's lowest class of felony. If convicted on all three charges, Hankison faces between 3 and 15 years in prison. USA Gymnastics and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee have reached a $380 million settlement with survivors of sexual abuse by former team doctor Larry Nassar. The deal includes a monetary payout as well as reforms at the organization to prevent future abuse. USA Gymnastics will be required to have at least one abuse survivor on its board of directors and create a restorative justice process for victims, among other provisions. Nassar was the team doctor for the U.S. Olympic gymnastics team and for years worked at USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University, where he later admitted to abusing multiple women and girls in a scandal that rocked the world of competitive gymnastics. Nassar was sentenced to 40 to 175 years in prison for sexual abuse in January of 2018. The following month, he was sentenced to another 40 to 125 years behind bars after pleading guilty to molesting young gymnasts at a Michigan training facility. He had previously been given a 60-year sentence on federal child pornography charges. John Manley, an attorney for some of the victims, said, quote, "These brave women relived their abuse publicly in countless media interviews so that not one more child will be forced to suffer physical, emotional, or sexual abuse in the pursuit of their dreams." You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st with your support. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned at 6 for Labor Radio, then at 6:30 it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with scattered rain showers and a high of 44. Today in history, in 2000, Vice President Al Gore concedes defeat to George W. Bush in his bid for the presidency, following weeks of legal battle over the recounting of votes in Florida. Bush and his running mate Dick Cheney took office in January of 2001, and Gore went on to become a renowned climate advocate. The quote of the day is from the American politician and environmentalist Al Gore, who served as the 45th U.S. Vice President. He said, quote, "Solutions to the climate crisis are within reach, but in order to capture them, we must take urgent action today across every level of society." Red states across the country are expected to pass copycat laws now that the U.S. Supreme Court has let the Texas six-week abortion ban stand. At the same time, the governor of California announces he will use the law to go after the gun industry. Roz Brown has more on the story.
Texas has captured headlines over its law banning nearly all abortions, but other states soon may share the spotlight after the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the Texas law to stand. The law bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, with no exceptions for rape or incest. It also promises a $10,000 bounty to citizens if they win a court case against anyone who has helped someone gain access to an abortion. At a virtual press conference Friday, ACLU attorney Julia Kay said if the Supreme Court overturns the constitutional right to an abortion, she expects roughly half the states to follow Texas's lead.
Five justices on the Supreme Court have shrugged their shoulders in the face of the catastrophic harm in Texas, ignoring 50 years of legal precedent forbidding states from stripping away our fundamental right to end a pregnancy.
The High Court's 5-4 vote said providers could still sue in federal court. Since the Friday decision, legal experts have warned that nearly every constitutional right is now at risk. And to that end, California Governor Gavin Newsom on Saturday called on lawmakers in that state to pass legislation modeled on the Texas abortion law as a strategy to go after the gun industry. Dr. Bhavik Kumar with Houston's Planned Parenthood Center for Choice noted how difficult the past 100 days have been on the center's staff.
Over and over again, we are forced to violate our conscience and our training and to turn away patients who need us. And we have no good answers to their questions of why this is happening or when it might end.
Amy Hagstrom-Miller oversees abortion clinics for Whole Women's Health and Whole Women's Health Alliance, including the center in McAllen. She called the court's decision unjust, cruel, and inhumane.
Our staff are heartbroken, scared, and discouraged. They're angry at having to serve as agents of the state against their will to enforce a law that they don't agree with.
Texas's Senate Bill 8 has been in effect since September 1st. I'm Roz Brown reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Western Kentucky grapples with the rising death toll from its deadly tornadoes. The FEMA administrator says more extreme weather events are likely due to climate change, and President Biden acknowledges inflation is hurting Americans. With more on all of these stories, we go to Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I just felt like this is going to be it. It's really going to happen. You know, this time, it's going to happen. You know, we're not going to get out of it this time.
Western Kentucky resident Karen Kitchens survived the deadly tornadoes that ripped through Kentucky, Arkansas, Missouri, and Tennessee. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear says he expects the death toll to rise to more than 100 and said they may prove to be the worst tornadoes in state history.
Kentucky is absolutely united. We're united with our people. We are united to find and rescue as many as possible. We are united to grieve with, I think, over 100 families that will have lost individuals.
Beshear also announced a Western Kentucky Tornado Relief Fund at teamwkyrelieffund.ky.gov. The Red Cross, Salvation Army, and other groups have also set up donation websites. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says extreme weather events will likely happen more frequently due to climate change.
There's going to be a lot to learn from this event and the events that we saw through the summer. We're seeing more intense storms, severe weather, whether it's hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires.
A UK judicial panel has ruled as valid a U.S. request to extradite Julian Assange. Under American espionage law, Assange could face up to 150 years in prison for publishing classified documents, alleging war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at the recent Summit for Democracy, Secretary of State Antony Blinken insisted the Biden administration fully supports a free press.
In July, the Department of Justice adopted a new policy to stop using subpoenas, warrants, and other investigative powers to obtain notes, work products, or other information from journalists engaged in news gathering activities.
Following the summit, President Biden spoke about the impact post-pandemic inflation is having on consumers.
The downside is prices have gone up because of supply chain concerns. We've worked as hard on the supply chain concerns.
A new report finds the world is dangerously unprepared for the next pandemic. Researchers scored every country on ability to prevent, detect, and respond to health emergencies. No country got above 76%. Stephen Morrison with the Global Health Policy Center says 2 years into COVID-19, most poorer countries remain woefully unvaccinated.
In low-income countries, we're still looking at vaccination levels at under 7-8%.
UNICEF has warned the pandemic poses the greatest threat to children, reversing progress on education, hunger, poverty, and abuse. Finally, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing calls to step down. A just-published photo shows Johnson breaking pandemic restrictions at a Christmas party last year. The UK faces a wave of new cases. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A federal bill aims to assist residents of one of the most economically depressed areas of the Navajo Nation, and tribal leaders turn out in force at the New Mexico legislature to protest an amended redistricting map. With those stories and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. For more than 4 decades, nearly all economic activity was halted on what was formerly known as the Bennett Freeze area of the Navajo Nation. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, a bill introduced recently in the U.S. House of Representatives aims to assist residents of one of the most economically depressed areas of the reservation.
In 1966, then Indian Affairs Commissioner Robert Bennett suspended nearly all development in much of the western portion of the vast Navajo Nation in northern Arizona. It was meant to resolve a land dispute between the Hopi and Navajo nations, but prevented thousands of residents from even making basic improvements and repairs to their homes. Many there still live without electricity and running water. Almost a decade later, Congress approved the Navajo-Hopi Settlement Act, forcing more than 16,000 people to relocate from their land. The freeze was repealed in 2009 by President Barack Obama, but widespread poverty persists in the area, largely larger than the state of Delaware. The House bill introduced by Arizona Democrat Tom O'Halloran would begin a housing construction and renovation program along with infrastructure improvements and other economic development for the area. It would also allow some families to receive relocation benefits, among other initiatives. Navajo President Jonathan Nez applauded the bill, calling it, quote, a matter of fundamental justice for the Navajo Nation. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
Federal officials approved renaming a peak in Colorado after a Cheyenne woman leader who helped maintain good relations between white settlers and Native Americans. Colorado Politics reports the peak in Clear Creek County is now Mestahay Mountain. It was the culmination of a four-year effort to remove the name and comes after Interior Secretary Deb Haaland from Laguna Pueblo ordered the word squaw removed from all federal lands. Mestahay, also known as Owl Woman, was married to William Bent and also helped negotiate trade among groups at Bent's Fort. It's the first name change recommended by Colorado's Geographic Naming Advisory Board. Governor Jared Polis originally said he would reject the recommendation because it was too hard to pronounce, and thus people would continue using the old name for the mountain. That drew backlash from Native American groups. Polis changed his mind and forwarded the recommendation to the U.S. Geological Survey's Board on Geographic Names. In New Mexico, state lawmakers replaced a redistricting map that a tribal coalition spent months working on to find consensus. Source New Mexico reports a Senate committee voted instead to approve an amended plan redrawing New Mexico's Senate's voting districts that was introduced just before the meeting. Senate President Pro Tem Mimi Stewart, a Democrat representing Albuquerque, introduced an amended map that would alter the layout of districts in northwestern New Mexico, where the Navajo Nation and other tribal nations are located. Members of the tribal coalition and elected tribal leaders showed up Sunday to speak against the amended map. They said the changes disrespected tribal autonomy and their hard work. Isaac Dakota Casado is chair of the state's Native American Democratic Caucus.
The 11th hour pass that we see today without consultation of our Native American tribes is not only a travesty, but it's a direct violation of much of the work that has been done, not for just today in the last couple of months, but for decades.
Tribal coalition members spent 8 months meeting among the state's 23 pueblos and tribes to achieve what they called a historic agreement on the maps. They sought to preserve Native American majorities of at least 65% in the legislative districts where they are already the majority, while honoring tribal boundaries and distinct communities within each district. The senators noted the map must still be approved by the full Senate, and more debate and changes could still take place. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes David Rosenberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Megan Kamrick, Sophia Muhammad, and Nadia Ramlagan. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. The podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11, it's Art Focus, which features interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means with host Joseph Gallivan. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
According to many political observers, the state of Wisconsin is on the front lines of the fight against the right-wing onslaught on democracy. Robert Craig is the executive director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about what the political right has been doing in his state.
Wisconsin has the most advanced now attempt to discredit the 2020 election. So it's sort of an advance on the Arizona audit, for example, which is, I guess, becoming the Texas audit as well, and potentially a Pennsylvania audit. The state legislature, which is Trump Republican, we have a moderate Democratic governor, they have appointed on their own a former right-wing Supreme Court justice who didn't run for election. He would have been hard to reelect, to do a fake investigation where he is trying to subpoena local officials. He is stating disinformation, but he's trying to give it his staff is secret. He has employed, because journalists have uncovered this, a whole number of Trump lawyers that were part of the conspiracy to basically steal the 2020 election. So this has been ongoing. It's been an ongoing scandal, and that's an ongoing investigation, and they're trying to threaten, intimidate local election officials to turn over all their records and their voting machines to this very secretive entity. But in addition, we have a Racine County sheriff, Racine's a major county in Wisconsin, filing felony charges against five of the six members of the Wisconsin Election Commission for running the election in a decent way and making sure nursing home workers in particular had a right to vote during a pandemic. Two Republicans and three Democrats. And it's decisions they made in 2020 that there were no Republican objections to, no lawsuits, no nothing. But because Donald Trump has now declared that loyalty to the party means loyalty to his big lie about the 2020 election, they are pursuing that. And in fact, they're trying to put pressure on DAs all over the state to file criminal charges. But then there is also an outright effort, Ron Johnson,